DevOps for Shipping Libraries with Jason Barris.
The Azure DevOps Podcast is a show for developers and DevOps professionals shipping software using Microsoft technologies. Each show brings you hard-hitting interviews with industry experts, innovating better methods, and sharing success stories. Listen on to learn how to increase quality, ship quickly, and operate well. And now your host, Jeffrey Palermo.
Welcome to the show. I'm Jeffrey Palermo, your host for helping you and your teams move fast, deliver quality, and run your software with confidence in Azure, all while using everything the .NET ecosystem has to offer. And I've been doing a lot of online user group speaking, as well as others. And so if you run a .NET or Azure-related user group, I'd love to give a presentation for you. Our sponsor for the podcast is ClearMeasure, and they make this podcast happen. We're a software architecture company that empowers .NET teams to be self-sufficient and able to deliver world-class results. And so if we can help, please get in touch. And if you're a .NET software engineer who wants a path to become an architect, we're hiring. I'd love to work for you. You can go to clearmeasure.com/careers. And before leaving that topic, I want to put out a call for a special role. I'm hiring another apprentice. I hired an apprentice last year, and he has grown so fast. He's already been promoted, and I'm coaching him through the next phase of the apprenticeship program. And so the apprentice that I'm looking for should be straight out of schooling, whether that be a degree program at a university or straight out of high school. Either is fine. If you or anyone you know loves to code and is convinced that being a professional software engineer is the career path for you, then please apply. My apprentice is going to work hand in hand with me in research and development, blazing the trail, creating patterns, templates, and guidance for developing and running applications with the latest in .NET and Azure. And then finally, be sure to check out the new video show, Architect Tips. That show is on episode 9 at the moment. And I'm really excited about our guest for today on the podcast. And we have none other than Jason Barris. He is the Senior Vice President for Developer Tools at Infragistics. Jason, welcome to the show. How are you, sir?
Thanks, Jeffrey. Thanks for having me. I'm doing great. Thank you.
Awesome. And we had Dean Guida on the show, episode 154. And he's your direct boss. Is that right?
Yep. He's the CEO. He founded the company about 30 years ago.
Awesome. Awesome. Yeah. Infragistics has been around for a while, but you pretty much run a big software engineering organization. That's, I guess, how I see it.
Yep. So my role at the company is, running product development, product management, but I've been there so long, almost 20 years, my hands are everywhere. So like talking to customers and doing customer meetings, public speaking, all that good stuff. But yeah, we're an engineering company. We have a lot of cool products that cover the gamut of technologies. When I started, of course, it was just .NET and life was simple with ASP.NET and Windows Forms back in 2002, 2003. Now it's everything from iOS, Android. Then you have technologies like Blazor, React, Angular, pure web components, while still having a massive .NET customer base. So things have changed over the years, but yeah, it's fun. It's interesting. Every day there's something new and there's something exciting to learn about, think about, and improve on what we're doing for customers.
Yeah. Now, in the first half of 2000 to 2010, you were authoring and co-authoring books and yep. speaking at conferences. And was there ever a time that you were not a computer programmer?
I started doing computer programming. Took classes in college, but then I was writing COBOL programs for a company in Michigan called Diversified Data, and it was COBOL. And we did like VAX Basic and a bunch of other stuff on IBM mainframes. And then I started doing Microsoft Access and Visual Basic, and then it all went from there, like the logical progression from the 90s to the 2000s with .NET. And, then of course now there's just such a wide variety of platforms and technologies. There's no way to keep up on all of it, Last week I'm watching a video on CSS Grid because I haven't used that. So you're sitting there like, how the heck can I apply this? And how does it compare to, you know, Flex and these other ways of doing layout in web? And how is it different than the way XAML did it? So that's the cool thing about technology is things are changing. There's new stuff all the time. And no matter how long you've been around, you have to keep doing this in order to stay sharp and on top.
Yeah. Yeah. Now we're on to .NET 5, .NET 6. And,
oh, yeah.
And so before we jump into our topic, just because of what your journey has been, I think a lot of developers listening here would probably love this question. Do you know when you decided that, you know what, I'm a programmer, I'm writing code all day, every day, and I love it, but I think maybe I would enjoy being a manager or being in a leadership role and actually guiding other people who are writing code all day?
Yep.
Do you remember when that point was?
I don't know necessarily. I think what happened was, and I didn't, maybe it was always there, but when I started at Infragistics and I was hired as a technical evangelist back then, but because I was so close to the development community, I mean, I was doing, you know, 50, 60 user group talks a year, writing books. You just start to realize that you're learning more stuff that can help the people inside, right? So I'm the interface to what people are asking for and what they're doing. So this leadership role just kind of grew over time. And then I had, you know, one person work for me, two people work for me. At Infragistics, I was given the opportunity to start our services group. So we started a whole services organization, hired people in UX roles, which was new to us back in like 2007, 2008. So I think, I don't know the exact time, but I think just the whole idea of leadership and being able to get information and share it with others so they could be more successful just kind of came naturally out of a lot of these opportunities I had at Infragistics in the first maybe 5 to 7 years that I worked there. And then after a while, it becomes a point, like, you know, you're just kind of the person that they go to inside the company. And so I just grew and, you know, end up where I'm at today. So yeah, it's been a cool journey. I know I've always loved computers. I've always loved programming and I love talking to people and helping them be successful. So it's kind of like a match made in heaven.
Let's dig into DevOps for shipping code as opposed to shipping applications. Now, Infragistics, a component company, you go to NuGet.org and just type in Infragistics and there's all kinds of packages you can download. But there's so many developers who maybe they don't even share any code externally, but one application team has a library or has some code that needs to be factored into a library that needs to be shared with other application teams. And so even within that company, they need some type of DevOps pattern for shipping a library.
Yep.
Whether it be a component or just some, you know, or just some helpers or whatnot. So you guys have a well-developed strategy around that. You do that all day long. What are some of the key pieces of that strategy and what's the guidance that you give your team on how to set that up properly?
I think the first thing, and we learned this a long time ago, and I learned this before I even started working at Infragistics, but was using their tools, is that the public API, how you name the API for the consumers of the component is critical. So it needs to just make sense. Some of the mistakes we made early on was maybe not following some of the naming patterns that Microsoft had already established. Or making APIs too deep. So properties, sub-properties for those properties where it was very confusing for people to learn. And over the years, the mantra we have is keeping a public API simple. You know, we have this thing called simple and beautiful at Infragistics, like everything we ship needs to be simple and beautiful. And that goes across all of our products, but ensuring that someone with knowledge of software development is in that process. So don't let the best developer in the room design your API because he may have never written an application. So over the years, we've had really great people work for the company. You know, Ambrose Little, who I'm sure you know.
Oh, yeah.
Brian Lagunas, who still works at Infragistics. But these guys come from an app development view of the world. So even though, let's say, for example, I'm coming back into, you know, a product meeting and saying, we need to do these X, Y, and Z features. Those guys, the app devs, need to be there because they need to help define how you would use that in the real world, what the right naming convention is, what the property should look like, what public function should look like, what should get exposed. And then people will be able to consume your library. Because if you don't do that, and maybe some very early folks of our Windows Forms products might remember this, it's just hard to use. When XAML came out, one of the mistakes we made with XAML in the very beginning was we made the API too much like Windows Forms, right? So a library consumer who was coming from Windows Forms thought it was great, but if you were a hardcore XAML guy and you're coming back from whatever Microsoft conference and you want to start using this great XAML library, the API didn't make sense to you because of the way that we didn't follow the established patterns in the market. So while we've innovated in some areas, the best thing that we can do is follow established patterns on public naming, public API, and then that gets out to the end consumer who buys our product and it's easy for them to use. If they can't get started within a few minutes and understand what to do, they're just going to drop us and go with the next competitor. So, and when we know that through, you know, just the years of shipping libraries like this.
Yeah. Yeah. And whether it's a UI component or whether it's just a library that, you know, does something, heck, one of our teams integrating with Twilio recently to send SMS messages. So guess what? There's a NuGet package to do so that we don't have to, but it's just a C# NuGet package, boom. And let's dive into the mechanics of how to do that. Because Team A, you know, they have a library. And somewhere Team B needs to use that library. And we don't want to drop a DLL on a network share. We want to use, you know, whether an internal NuGet server or whatnot, or somehow we need to share, we need to build, test, package it up, version it, and then Team B needs to get access to it and be able to pull it in just like any other library. What are the mechanics that are essential that you guys have for that process?
Yep. So it varies across products. So for example, web products are different than maybe the Blazor products or an iOS product or Windows Forms WPF product. Each different technology has its own tools and sets of tools. We do take advantage of things like Azure Pipelines for Reveal, which is a BI product that we ship to the market. Internally for brand new Blazor product, we're using on-prem Visual Studio and we're using Visual Studio builds for that process. And that's all on-site internally through servers that we run. And then things like, Angular and React and web components, we're using build processes in the cloud that are all free. They're just all open source and, you know, right through GitHub Actions, we're doing kicking off builds and creating libraries that way. But really, one of the nice things with Microsoft Visual Studio and moving forward into things like Blazor, .NET 5, .NET 6, and I might have even started earlier, was SDK style projects. So once we took an old Visual Studio project that had or solution that probably had hundreds of projects, right? So shared libraries, then we have libraries for every single component that we ship. Creating an SDK style project for that allows us to target different frameworks just automatically in the build process, where before we would have to upgrade and we had to maintain a lot of different projects to go through that entire build process to output DLLs, executables in some cases based on the tool that the developers would consume. And then there's obviously post-build process that packages it up. How are we going to package this? Is it a modern Visual or a modern Windows installer like the MSI packages? Is it a NuGet package? Is it something that we have to deploy to GitHub? So based on the product, that flow is going to be different. And each one of those takes time to set up. It's like there's teams of people. That's all they do is the build process and ensuring that those targets in a continuous integration, continuous delivery are happening, you know, every night. And the unique thing about what we do is the pre-build, post-build process also does source code translation. So we have many of our products start in C sharp, and then we translate those to Objective-C. We translate those to Swift. We translate them to Java native languages, and then we build to target those platforms. So if you want to use our products to build an Android application, for example, you would have a native Android. I think it's a jar file, and then there's APKs, which you could go out and those are the outcome of a build, but just different build things are happening based on how we target different platforms. So our Blazor product is actually a product that starts in C sharp, and we build it, boil it down to a pure web component. And then we have native C sharp wrappers around that. So there's multiple steps for that. And then ultimately that builds out into a NuGet package that we deploy to NuGet.org. And we have private repositories, you know, licensed and unlicensed products to make that happen. And then deploying for us means, you know, NPM public, NuGet public. And then we have a private repo for licensed customers that they'll log in with their ID, and that gives them access to private repositories for NPM or NuGet. And then it removes watermarks and things like that. But the process based on the product is going to be very different. And the tools are very different. The capabilities of those teams are absolutely different. So the folks that are building our Angular product, for example, are not and wouldn't even know how to begin to start to deal with the .NET side or, and so when you start bringing them together, so for example, you know, we have a team that builds web components, and now another team is building translation, or they own a translation technology and they build these wrappers, they have to work together and they have completely different process. So it's a little bit different for each one, but we're using, you know, every technology that you can think of, starting from that initial library project, SDK project, all the way to, you know, is it Cucumber with SpecFlow for automated testing? Is it, you know, Karma on the web? And is there translation steps in between that we have to run locally? And then we're pushing out to the cloud. So yeah, that's sort of a little high level, but each area ends up being something that we need expertise in because they're so different than it was back when it was just on-prem Visual Studio, TFS, and we're using all of the Microsoft build tools to just get an output of either a bunch of DLLs or executables. And at the same time, you know, we're doing this where people can build night, they can, our customers can grab nightly builds, right? So if you go to our NuGet, .org, or if you go to NPM, there's builds that you can grab because there might be a bug fixed in a specific branch that is built for you, but it doesn't have other things tested in it. So we allow customers to pick off those builds as they need them, with the caveat that something else might be broken in there. And then we have official, you know, release builds that go out, you know, on a monthly basis, probably for most products.
Mm-hmm. Now, just honing in on the .NET side of things, as opposed to anything with NPM or Node. You mentioned NuGet packages. With Azure Pipelines, there's the ability to just store arbitrary files, and then some people are just zipping things up. You guys use NuGet packages for everything. Can you share your reasoning and your recommendation for what package format people should be gravitating towards?
Yeah, I'm pretty sure for most of the stuff, we're using the zip format. I'm not 100% sure on that actual specific detail, but for us, in terms of NuGet being critical, is that any product can consume the NuGet package, right? So we don't really have to worry about it or care.
That NupKeg file?
Yes, exactly. Yes. So that package file, you can be using VS Code, you can be using Visual Studio, and to get up and running with our products is literally one line of code. Now, for some products on top of that, we build a little bit, some CLI tooling. But at the end of the day, that package file does allow us just broad distribution immediately for whatever the heck we happen to be building or fixing that day.
Many thanks to our podcast sponsor, Clear Measure. Clear Measure is a software architecture company that empowers clients' development teams to be self-sufficient, moving fast, delivering quality, and running their systems with confidence. Whether starting a new project or developing new technologies or techniques, Clear Measure sets up your team to deliver world-class results. Learn more at www.clearmeasure.com. Clear Measure, empowering software delivery.
You mentioned testing, which I think is key, because if we could guarantee that there was no bugs, then just build, you know, compiling and packaging and distributing would be all we cared about. But with a packaged up library, there's what testing tools or what testing process allows you to actually go through the motions of retrieving a NuGet package, putting it into a consuming project, and then making sure that that actually worked, as opposed to, oh, this new version, it's broken, but we don't know it's broken until some application developer tries to actually pull it in.
Yep. So we have, over the years, in fact, we have blogs on this on infragistics.com, like our entire end-to-end processing, or testing process. So the biggest thing for us maybe 10 or 11 years ago is we started to build an internal tool based on spec flow, using Gherkin with Cucumber, which allowed us to do a lot of that automation up front.
Okay, you're going to have to define those. You're going to have to find Gherkin, because there's some listeners who have never heard that term before.
Yeah, if you go, these are all open source projects. And the idea is that Gherkin is a syntax that works with a .NET testing tool called SpecFlow, which lets you do behavior-driven development. So when Jeffrey and I are talking about a new feature to add to a chart, where like when you hover the mouse over and you click something, a tooltip should show up. Or if I'm using a data grid and I move a column from right to left, this thing should happen. So it should be, the column should move, it should animate, and all the data should be the same. You know, when this happens, like give me the context, this event occurs, and here's the specific outcome. The reason these tools are cool is because they let you narrate that in plain English. So anyone can start writing tests against SpecFlow with Cucumber, which will run the tests for you. And what we've done over the years is we have testing frameworks internally on the .NET side and even on the web side. And that uses, I believe it was... I guess SpecFlow or Gherkin started to pull in, SpecFlow pulled in the Selenium web driver so you could automate web browsers.
Yep.
But it allows us to write 100% automation for everything that we know or we think should happen. So mm-hmm. when we build a feature into a component, there's an expected outcome of some event occurring, you know? And what I tell customers is that we are not only your UI component team, but we're also your testing team. So we can help you reduce such a huge amount of bugs. So it's not just the automation from, I'm going to deploy this NuGet package, and when I pull it in, let's make sure that it adds to the project correctly. I have the right versions of the latest, and then it doesn't break other older stuff, but it also does all of the functional operational testing of those components. So for something like let's take our Blazor chart probably has 40,000 tests that run when we check in code, right? The grid probably has 60,000 tests that run when we check in code, and those will run because of our translation technology. They'll run on native iOS, native Android, they'll run in WPF, whatever language or platform we're targeting that, you know, deployment package for. And that goes all the way from, okay, here's a test bed. The whole process starts by pulling in that package from the very beginning that we're saying we want to test. It installs it. It'll load it up. We have, you know, all the tests ready to run and it'll start cycling through. And when you watch the screen, you can actually see windows popping up, things moving, and they close instantly. So this also means that, you know, the better hardware you have, the faster it's going to go, because when you're running potentially 100 and some thousand tests multiple times a day, that could really kind of clog up your system. But the entire end-to-end processing for us is automated, and we've built technology internally over time, but everything is available via open source. So Cucumber as a testing framework, yep. SpecFlow as a testing framework, Gherkin, Selenium drivers. And then on the website, things like Karma, Jasmine, these are all, Jasmine you would use for test definition, sort of like you would use for SpecFlow. And then Karma would run those tests, and you can just do all of those with, you know, GitHub Actions in the cloud and have testing, you know, which when we ship bugs, it's not a good thing. When Infragistics really got into the whole .NET, ecosystem in 2002, 2003, and we didn't have, there was no capability to do this type of testing. There's nothing existed. So we're using what we can. The problem is when you change code, and you know this, you're just potentially introducing more bugs to other aspects of the system. And some of those releases back in like 2005, I mean, a bug, we would do these things called, they were monthly patches. I forget what we actually call them, but back then we would only ship twice a year or three times a year. So you just release these patches of bug fixes. But there were so many bug fixes that were so important, it was almost like a release.
Yeah.
And that's when you realize we have a problem, right? So what can we do to fix that? And I would say it took a few years because we had to build technology and use what was available. But now if you're shipping bugs, you probably just need to understand the scenarios more, make sure you know how customers are using your library. And then every time today, a support case comes in, that support case informs new tests that get done. So, okay, we did make a mistake. Here's a bug. Let's make sure we write a test for this so it doesn't happen again. It doesn't mean we're not shipping zero bugs, but it does mean that we are improving that 80-20 use case scenario, where if we can really ship product where most people are not running into a single issue, then life is good.
Yes.
Where I can tell you what you specifically asked around, we would ship something. I mean, we have shipped major releases in 2006 where it wouldn't install, right? But we shipped it, and we have marketing mailers going out and all this stuff. We didn't have the test automation back then. And then of course, that's when you also start to realize, oh, this specific version of Windows or this specific version of .NET, we're not taking that into consideration when we're installing. So through test automation today, once we do a build, and then there's a whole series of tests that are happening in those builds, but then we're automating that through existing samples and sample browsers and other things, all of that has to work end to end before we ship. So now if you install an Infragistics product or a product from Reveal, which is our BI tool, our Ignite UI products or Slingshot products, and you can't install it, then please call me, because that should never, ever happen.
Right. Now, you mentioned a whole lot of testing tools, but specifically Cucumber, Selenium, and with Blazor, because it's being adopted so fast, those technologies are used to browser refreshes, whereas Blazor just kind of stays. So has now, this may be too much in the weeds, but have those tools solved the issue of knowing when an operation is complete after, say, clicking a button on a Blazor screen, when it doesn't, there's no new, you know, browser refresh that they normally hook onto?
So that's a good question. They must be doing something, because we're still using these technologies, right? Now, we do a lot of testing that comes before the browser.
Yeah.
So like, for example, once we, going back to the fact that most of this stuff starts in C#, once that happens, we know that the functional thing works, right? The function of the grid will work because we did it in WPF.
Yeah.
So, okay, now we figure that we've been translating to web component for, you know, 5 years, and the web component translation has its own set of tests. So it will go ahead and test just those functional aspects of it in a browser. Now, within a single page application, when I have multiple components interacting with each other, we do have interactive tests. So be it the Selenium drivers or things that we've done internally with timing, those tests do happen, and they have to pass before we ship. So something is working there, either on the Selenium side or something that we've built. I'm just not sure which one it would be.
Yeah. Now, what would you say to anybody who, whether they're a manager or just an individual developer, that says, we've got to ship features, we don't have time to write all this automated testing code?
You can't. So you have to do automation. Okay. So we had a product manager, and he's no longer with the company, but we have a product called Share Plus. It was the first ever native iOS iPad app for SharePoint. And it was shipped like the day the App Store shipped, right? The day the iPad shipped, we shipped Share Plus. And the beauty of it was, it allowed you to synchronize stuff down to your iPad so you could be disconnected and still have access to your SharePoint, which was just unbelievable back in 2011 or 10, I guess. So now that product manager, we would always be in these product meetings, and he would have this pyramid, and he would have like, you know, resources, time, and quality, right? And he's like, which one do you want? You know, which one's more important to you? Putting more resources on this to ship the product, the time it's going to take to ship it, or is it the quality? And no matter what, you have to be a mature engineering manager, product manager, product owner, and you have to ensure that you're doing the testing. If you don't do the testing, the molehill becomes a mountain before you know it. And there's so much research done on this, on software failures. Like, you can just search the web. How much money is, how many hundreds of millions to billions of dollars is lost every year on failed software projects? And the reason is, yeah, maybe they didn't include customers in their design. Maybe they didn't follow a UX process, but a lot of it is because the software just never worked, right? So when I lived in Florida back in the day, the city of Miami hired Oracle to build the next generation of Miami's, all of their government software. And after, you know, billions of dollars in years, there was still nothing to show. And the city of Miami was going bankrupt, actually paying Oracle for nothing. Mm. And this is, these stories happen over and over again. So you have to really come with data to your manager and explain to them that without quality, we will never get traction. At Infragistics, we learned this the hard way back in the very beginning of shipping .NET. But now we know, like, hey, if we're going to build a feature, it has to have tests, it has to have automation, and we have to have that code coverage. So start using all these tools, and they're all available. They're all part of what you're using, either be it Visual Studio or your web tools like GitHub will tell you code coverage on how many tests do we actually have. We have functional tests, we have unit tests. Use these tools that are available, because without high quality software, you will get nowhere. It has to work, because there's so many options now. And I think even an app, if an app takes longer than, I don't know, 30 seconds to install, people move on.
Yeah.
Right. So no one has,
this must be frozen.
Yeah. And you know, the Gartner and all these sales experts say by the time a customer actually talks to you, they have 70% of their mind made up. They've already looked at every other vendor. So it's not like it was 15 years ago where they're going to stick with you and give you a chance. No way. They don't care. There's too many choices, too many options, and there's too many great products in the market where if you want to compete, high quality testing has to be part of it.
You mentioned that project triangle, the trade-offs between time, resources, it's features, time, and quality.
Yep.
Because time is resources. I'm wondering if that's a fallacy when it's applied to software. I want you your opinion on
it
this.
It is.
If you applied it to a car, then maybe it makes sense because of quality of materials and whatnot. But in software, you say, okay, you know, we're going to trade off quality a little bit. So now we get an extra bug. Well, that bug is in a feature that we thought we delivered, but now because we accidentally broke it, we have to take away the feature, and now we've no longer delivered that feature. So we thought we were going to trade off some quality, but we actually lost feature, the different side of the triangle.
Am I off base? That's absolutely true. Yep. And you know, there's been decades of research done on the cost of shipping a bug, right? So if a bug, if a defect, not a like a defect in design, code, whatever, if you catch it before you ship, it costs, or if you catch it during the design phase, right, it costs a dollar, right? So you're designing something. You're not even, you're just architecting, and you're, it's UX architecture, application architecture, library architecture, costs a dollar. Once you start building it, it'll cost you $10 to fix that defect if you don't catch it. And that's before it goes to market. Once it goes to market, multiply that by 10. It's $100 to fix it. And we know those are just like 110, 100 is just a, it's the 10X of cost. The 10X of cost is millions of dollars, right? So when you ship something and you don't catch that bug, and a customer has to call you and tell you that, hey, this thing that's been working forever now doesn't work, that is where you start losing huge amounts of money, not only in support costs, but, you know, customer sat, renewals, whatever. I mean, there's the numbers are phenomenal. And you can't just throw more resources at a problem to ship it. And we know that as well. So let's say we want to ship a feature. And, you know, we have this product Slingshot. And Slingshot now is in a public preview. We've been building it for several years. Could we have shipped it in a year if we quadrupled our team? There's no way we could have shipped it in a year if we quadrupled our team. It doesn't work that way. And anymore, if you do not include UX from the beginning with dev, like a UX team with the lead devs, the lead architects, and you design it together with customers included, you will never ship a product that will be accepted by the market. So that's where a lot of these mistakes happen. And if you're not spending the right time and resources up front in that iterative cycle of design and development, and then finally, when you're building, you should be pretty sure you're still testing with customers, but you're actually building software, and hopefully you're not writing bugs as part of that. But the cost is huge. There's a ton of fallacies, you know, so many good books on this, like Code Complete. And there was another one I read, I forget the name, but you just learn, like, wait a minute, not all problems can be solved with money or people. You have to do the time up front to make sure that this software is actually going to be successful, which is why it's so cool when you use a tool like Visual Studio and you look at what Microsoft is doing with all of this, everything available to you as a developer on Azure. The tools are all there. It's up to you to take advantage of them. And most of them you can use for free, either with a limit of some sort, or at least get your process going. And the cost is very low over time if you're turning things off and only using it when you need it, et cetera. So right now the tooling is all there. And that's why I love Microsoft, is the tooling that they just ship for a developer in Visual Studio is unbelievable to ensure that you're writing higher quality code than ever before. It's up to you as a team to ensure, you know, UX and all these other things are in there as well.
Right, right. Wow. Fascinating. Fascinating. We appreciate you coming on the show. And again, how many engineers are in your organization?
So right now it's about half the company, maybe a little bit more. We're about 300 people total. So, across a bunch of teams, it's a lot.
So any engineering challenge that is out there, you guys have probably encountered it and had to move through it.
We have some of the smartest people. And you know what's interesting about smart people is not every smart person wants to do the next great thing. Like, what I mean is, just because there's artificial intelligence or all this other great stuff, it doesn't mean they want to do it. So when we have guys that have been just doing .NET forever, guys that have been doing .NET DevOps forever, guys that have been doing web and all of this cloud stuff since it was available. So you've got all this, these areas of expertise, and so many brilliant developers, and then couple that with good product management, good product owners, and it kind of comes together to what you see in the market. So we're not a huge company, but we basically do it all. You know, we're a very mature software company, and you know, I've been doing this now for 30 years.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, thanks for sharing the your perspective and what kinds of challenges you've solved there at Infragistics. It's been a fascinating interview. I appreciate you coming on the show.
Yep. Thanks, Jeffrey. I appreciate it.
And until next time, keep shipping.
You've been listening to the Azure DevOps Podcast, a show for developers and DevOps professionals shipping software using Microsoft technologies. Go to www.azuredevops.show for show notes and other episodes. On behalf of your host, Jeffrey Palermo, and our sponsors, thanks for listening, and may God bless you.